Hello, you're listening to Spoiler-Filled Film Conversation. Hooray! And this is part two of our special retrospective episode we did for our 150th episode. And this is where we deal with our favourite podcasts. So I'll hand over to myself and the rest of the gang. Bloop! So, if you're still interested, we are doing our top five favourite shows, just shows we had a good old time having a chat about, and we think are a good selection of both. The film is interesting to talk about, and the conversation we had is a nice one to listen to if you're trying to, you know, find out what we're about. The point is, we recommend these conversations. We just wanted to mention these films because they're gems in some way, good or bad.
Hang on a minute now, because I'm looking at the list here and I don't agree.
The chats were gems. The films were gems because they inspired some fun conversations.
Yeah. Also, no particular order for this one other than the obvious top, which we'll get to when it's time.
Yes. So, nominally, in at number five, Willy Dynamite from 1974. The brilliantly named and fabulously dressed pimp, played by Roscoe Orman of Sesame Street fame, finds out the hard way that pimpin' ain't easy, man. Pimpin' ain't easy.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, did a wrestling reference. Good on me.
Oh, this is the whitest podcast on iTunes.
Shut up. Get on board the whore train. Get on board the whore train.
Come on, boy. Get on the whore train.
The whore train. So I picked this one because I'm brilliant and I love 70s blaxploitation. I love the blacks being exploited. That's me.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
In the form of cinema, not in real life. No, it's great. No, it's a fabulous genre. We also did the film Coffee. I just love it because it gives you everything you want, which is guns, sex, cars, violence. It's just, it knew what people wanted. And I personally love it as a genre. You know, it's just always fascinating. The hats and clothes, everything. And Willy Dynamite is a funny name, a funny character, and my God, the clothes and the car he has.
Yeah.
It's just the best.
Just so much about this film is just so memorable. Like you say, the costumes, his car, the way they speak, like the characters.
His nutsack gun. He's got a gun he keeps in his catsuit next to his balls. Willy D, because that's where he packs his dynamite, in the Willy. He has so many meanings to his name, even more than you think.
Yeah, and this film just ended up being a lot more nuanced and just good.
I shocked that's you what I mean,
as we were expecting.
I shocked
you. there was a surprising depth to it as it went on that I was not expecting.
Because definitely on the surface, you think you have this movie pegged from the start, but you don't.
Abby, did you love the D? Sorry, did you love the Willy? Whichever you prefer.
I don't remember.
It's been a while.
But I do remember marvelling a lot of the time. Just looking at a room and going, oh.
I remind you of the, what did we call it? The League of Extraordinary Pimps.
Yeah. That's definitely the scene whenever...
Oh, so good.
I remember this film, that's what I remember.
And in fairness to the ladies, there's some wicked-looking prostitutes in this as well. Some amazing wigs, some amazing hoe wardrobes, and they're all, styling and profiling. And some great court scenes. Like, you know, if you like a bit of trashy TV, they have a court scene with late night court business going on, mothers fainting and having strokes or heart attacks. It's, what a film.
Yeah, it just delivers everything you could want from a blaxploitation film. I think we discuss in the film that there's two different kinds. There's the really silly kind, which is just all-out action and boobs. Yeah. And then there's the really kind of gritty, grimy, really tense drama side. And it kind of melds both of them really well and unexpectedly.
It does. It just tells the downfall of one particular guy trying to, you know, hustle and be the best pimp in the city or whatever. Like, but he ends up finding it's really hard to be an on-the-nose pimp where you... You know, when the cops know you're a pimp because of how you dress, how you park, and the way you carry yourself, they just fuck you, and you'll never succeed if you're that blatant. And it grinds him down. It's great.
You reminded me of one of my favourite ongoing parts of the film, the car, and the fact that the car is the symbol of Willie D's like arrogance and what he thinks of himself and
him being stripped away slowly as it goes on. Yeah.
Also, one of the best things about this film is Roscoe Orman as Willie Dynamite, because he actually does put in a great performance, and he's really charismatic and animated and fun to watch.
Yeah. I mean, he falls between sympathetic and a dickhead, and you really don't know how you feel, and it changes as the film goes on and everything. Like, it is a really quite a good film. And one of the things on Spoilerfield we like to do is endlessly discuss decorations, hats, and wigs, and moustaches. And this has got it in spades. We love a good moustache spot, or, I mean, just the whole thing is, oh, look at that. Oh, that's, is that leopard? Is that, that's lamb. That's pure lamb right there. Oh, that's good. So there's incredible wardrobe work. And we like putting that spot. That's basically all we do in Spoilerfield is go, God, that hat, though. And this keeps giving in that department.
Spoiler-filled hat conversation.
Spoiler-filled, look at that hair conversation. Oh my God, did you see her shoes? The shoes, oh my God. And wallpaper. I think very early on we were wallpaper fans. Of like, oh, that scene with the wallpaper. Anyway, I have nothing else to add, but anyone else?
I don't know, I think this is just one of those ones where, like, me in particular... I feel like I am the most distanced from this film culturally. So I feel like I want to talk, but I don't want to talk too much.
you are what they might call a honky.
you start to sort of, you get really enthusiastic talking about it, and then you realise you may be towing a line culturally, and you're like, I should maybe be a little bit more careful.
It is difficult for four white people to chat about something that is already called blaxploitation. I'm happy to wade in because I have no self-awareness and don't know when I'm being appropriate or not. But no, I think it is important to realise we know nothing of this world, and that's kind of why it's fascinating. And, you know, it's a heightened reality sometimes anyway. Like, films are always like a reflection of reality. So I think it's safe to talk about them without worrying about have we said something wrong about a culture or a time or place or whatever.
It's not so much in my case, have I said something wrong? Just, I feel like, do I actually know anything about it at all?
Well, Abby, wrong, you had that short time right. Where you were a bottom bitch. I mean, that relates. You've given up your massive wig days, though. That's behind you. You now work in retail, selling people blaxploitation films and other genres.
I have sold Willie Dynamite, actually.
Huh.
That's nice.
Somebody bought it.
Someone called Willie bought some dynamite. I didn't know you sold. Oh, I'm terrible. Good. Best of luck to them. I hope they listen to the podcast. Moving on, though, guys.
They don't.
That didn't need saying. It was obvious. I picked the film Willie Dynamite.
I didn't like the pause you put on that.
You have to do it every time, I've noticed, as well. Willie
Dynamite. Willie Dynamite is not a venereal disease. It's many things. It's such a... let's be honest, I picked this film because it's called Willie Dynamite.
We know.
So I think I had quite moderate expectations, just for probably... a little bit of Swayzes, a little bit of gunplay, a little bit of boobs, and a lot of just generally being a bit grimy.
The man throughout the film wears ridiculous coloured cat suits, literally gold and silver shoes at various points, massive collars, various types of like furry lampshades. I cannot get over how insane he looks. Each outfit is a new like success in tacky, over-the-top, what-the-fuckness.
I'd rather rape a watermelon.
Thank you. That was probably the best quote. Number four. The last unicorn. She was the last unicorn.
Number three.
It was from 1983. And Maya...
82.
Was it 82?
Yeah.
Not according to IMDb, it wasn't.
I'm looking at IMDb right now.
Not according to Wikipedia, it wasn't.
Either way, it was rubbish.
Early 1980s, The Last Unicorn. Maya Farrow voices a naive unicorn that teams up with a oddly Jewish wizard called Schmendrick, voiced by Alan Arkin. Together, they attempt to free the rest of her species from a selfish king and his magical red bull, not the energy drink.
Let's not ignore the fact that this was a Rankin Bass animated feature, and for some reason that I don't really understand, people always praise Rankin Bass cartoons, but they drive me nuts. I didn't like The Hobbit at all. Mm.
Don't they make ice cream?
And I just think.
What's the name of the brand that sounds like Rankin?
Ben and Jerry? I think you're thinking of Baskin Robbins.
Baskin Robbins.
Oh, yeah, you're wrong. Right. No, Rankin Bass made ugly, crap animated features.
Including
in
this.
The 70s, yeah, and 80s. And I think because back then no one knew any better, they just watched them and enjoyed them. Because that Hobbit thing is awful. I mean, the Peter Jackson Hobbit films are shit as well, but like...
I'm not disagreeing.
There's something so ugly about their art style.
Yeah, we talk about that in the podcast. In fairness,
And it's just, I don't know, this film just annoyed me for the most part. Parts of it were okay, but
there's a lot I liked about it. Like Anthony, it was your pick, so maybe you can enlighten us on some of your thoughts then.
This is kind of like a long stretch of. Kind of our childhood films that we brought to the table to essentially be slaughtered by everyone else.
Oh, yeah, because I did Fern Gully.
No, didn't Abby picked Fern Gully?
Did she?
Abby picked it.
Oh, yeah, that was my sacrificial lamb, remember? I felt bad because you had all brought childhood stuff to the table and we'd eviscerated them completely.
Oh, yeah, because mine was ages ago, Super Mario Brothers.
And Rock and Rule as well.
And Rock and Rule was a mystery film that I thought I dreamed,
oh, right.
And it turned out it was real and it was rubbish.
Should have dreamed
but still
it.
A nightmare.
Yeah.
Yes, very much so.
But anyway, like the Last Unicorn kind of has a special place in my heart because of that. Like I think there's like genuine moments of kind of like beauty and mystery in there, but it is a very strange film.
I mean,
a lot of questionable things going on.
It has a tree woman with massive tits that won't let go of Schmendrick the wizard and is crushing him into her bosom.
There's a lot of inappropriate boobage going on generally in the movie.
But it has loads of like great scenes that are fun to chat about. That the scenes where like the unicorn turns into a woman at one point. There's points where the cast sort of forget what they were doing, like as part of the plot. There's a fantastic scene with a drunken skeleton torso that has to be tricked with invisible wine. There's some really good scenes that make
that
for good. It was amazing. There's loads of bits in there. There's like a pirate cat. I don't know how a pirate cat can be in a film and still it's shit. But there's lots of pieces to discuss, and that's one of the fun things about doing the show is when you have so much fuel to question things. And like the woman who has her band of ugly merry men, like there's lots of characters and moments that I loved thinking about, but if you just watch it, you can't watch the film alone and just enjoy it unless you're brain dead. But if you have people to watch it with or to discuss it with, it's so good. I love The Last Unicorn, not because it's perfect or because it's terrible, but because it has so many things I don't understand that I want to discuss with people.
It is interesting, and I can see why if you'd seen it as a kid, A, you would have enjoyed it, and also you'd still have a nostalgic attachment to it. Mm. But watching it for the first time as an adult, it was just kind of like, oh, this is annoying. Apart from like a few key moments, the one that really stands out to me is the skeleton that they have to bribe.
Yeah, with invisible... It's very clever. There's some good stuff
in it.
But there's no reason for that. Oh, no, there's so much... Again, it's one of those films that lacks motivation for a lot of the characters. Like, the very start of the film is because... The Last Unicorn doesn't even know she's the Last Unicorn until some random strangers are like, you're the last one, bitch!
Like, also, Mia Farrow can't sing.
Well, oh, my God. No. Painful.
Abby, would you like to express anything about The Last Unicorn?
I just spent most of my time watching it going, why is Alan Arkin in this?
Why is
and is he scripted, or did they just say, just make some shit up?
When did they come up with the visual first and then cast Alan Arkin? Or did they, like, why does the wizard have a massive big nose? And is that saying something about his Jewishy sounding voice?
Yeah,
or are we reading too much into this? Or am I reading too much into this? I don't know.
No, there's definitely is this...
I mean, he's called Schmendrick.
Is there an anti-Semitic thing going on down, like...
And he's a kind of a useless wizard, so are they... Again, I'm like, did Hitler have a hand in this? Is this propaganda for discrediting the Jewish community by having a feckless wizard be I don't know. Maybe it's innocent, but I felt it was doing an injustice or doing something wrong.
Number three.
before I get into more trouble.
The only character from this point on that I liked was Molly Grew.
Ugly one of the bunch.
But that's probably why I liked her, actually, because she was the least offensive to look at.
I love her reaction to the unicorn as well. She's like, where the fuck have you been? Where were you when I was 10?
Yeah.
I love how bent out of shape she was, because it's like, I am old now, I believed in magical unicorns, and I wanted to meet you, and now you turn up now when I'm out of my prime, bitch.
Her realism, her character is basically saying, look where I live, and all these fucking idiots that I live with. I could have been so much more than this weird forest common law wife.
Posse of golems.
Who I would imagine is passed around these moustached men.
Oh my gosh, don't even
think about this. She's the only woman there.
Unicorn! I held you! Number three. This is my choice and I love it.
Oh, Christ.
The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars from 1998. So this is literally the plot. A bunch of kitchen appliances fly to Mars in a laundry basket, possibly fueled with the dress of a Christmas decoration. And they are going there to save a baby from an evil dictator fridge that is controlled by one of Albert Einstein's hearing aids. Yeah, that's right. That's the film. It's about appliances go to Mars inexplicably. All that thing I just said... That's actually the plot. That isn't me using hyperbole. That's the plot.
If anyone wanted to know what the inside of your head was like, I'd tell them to watch this film.
Well, personally, let me defend myself. I love The Brave Little Toaster, the first one. I think it's quite a good cartoon from my childhood. The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars, fucking insane. Like, it's inexplicably random. It's got concepts that I like, but have come out of nowhere. And there's so many leaps in logic. Like, science fiction's fine, because it has to make stuff up. It is fictionalising science for the narrative. But this, you just go, I don't think popcorn in a microwave is enough to power a spaceship.
Like this was an educational animated movie teaching kids about space or anything like that.
Tried to talk about actual stuff. Like, made references, that's what we talk about in the podcast, is it actually makes references that you'd understand if you were educated about space exploration, but it also has talking fridges dancing to a fascist regime, I don't know.
Yeah, with all the weird adult plot lines going on, and it's like the Flintstones movie with all that shit about unions. Like, why is that in a kid's film? They're not going to know what the hell all this is.
Yeah.
Why is there a dictatorship on Mars?
Yeah, and kids like animation films like this are usually, they're usually kind of insane and stupid and not logical in the slightest, but this one is just on another level.
This is definitely Brave Little Toaster is fairly well regarded. I think we should try and maybe make another one to, like, capitalize on the name. I know it came out a while ago, but do you have any ideas? And they all sat around for ages, not saying anything, trying to think of something. And
trying,
then one
trying
of them
to
went,
ignore the book that exists of the yeah. film.
And then the other one went, what if Brave Little Toaster goes to Mars? And they all went, yeah, that sounds all right. And then nobody wrote the script until the deadline.
And then they went, oh, shit, the master's child floated off in a bubble. Yeah. We need a music scene. Some balloons are floating away. They just sing about floating, and we have the balloons sing. Then they're on Mars. What's on Mars? 50s technology is outdated and was shipped up to Mars because it's obsolete. It was designed to be obsolete.
I'm going to make a very British-specific and dated reference here, but I think the way this film came together is very similar to that episode of Black Books where Bernard and Manny try and come up with a children's book.
Yeah. That's a good point if you know the reference. It is just...
The whole film does feel like a giant game of Mad Libs gone wrong.
It does, yeah. It's just like just everything from Einstein's hearing aid to like a Christmas fairy... Like the very fact that we have obsolete characters from the first films, there's just like there's a rat from like the sequel to the first film, and it's just in there to be a crap character they cut back to. It's just there's too many characters, and Farrah Fawcett is a character I think they make up just because of the pun exists. Like Farrah
yes,
Fawcett voices a Fawcett.
You're right.
It's the film that keeps giving. It's so weird.
It's one of those few films that genuinely seems like it was made by accident.
Yeah.
And somehow everything accidentally came together and they went, oh shit, we made a film. What are we going to do with it?
What's great is if you think people painstakingly animated this.
Yeah.
It takes time. You can't just throw an animation together.
Poor souls.
Abby, I'd like you to remember your traumatic or pleasant experiences of the podcast, if you may.
I'm having a little bit of a problem now because I've look at dancing to do stuck in my head.
This is
out of the actual thought.
I think the perfect criticism for films like this, and I can't remember if I said it in this episode, but I know I said it about Fern Gully, is that if you try and watch an animated movie with a child and they get bored and wander off, that probably tells you everything you need to know about that film.
Yeah. I mean, that is the monitor. Sometimes Jamie and his son can sit down and watch them, and that's the tell. Avi, have you got anything else you want to add? Have you cleared? Has the fog cleared? Are the songs receding? Is there anything you want to say? Because last chance.
There's a group of films that actually make me want to physically slap whoever was in charge of making it. Like, actually track them down and just slap them in the face.
Yeah.
But you couldn't, so you just hit Rich.
The good
you know,
news,
I didn't,
Abby...
I might.
The good news is we never have bothered with the Brave Little Toaster to the rescue, where the Brave Little Toaster tries to help his veterinary master with the problems of a vet sanctuary. I don't know,
what?
Vet sanctuary is that thing? Vet place. So we got that. It's not very good, but it's not terrible like this film was.
How? Oh, my cat broke his leg. Don't worry, my toaster will help.
I don't know. The rat from this film
everywhere
isn't it?
Has a kitchen, Jamie.
Oh, yeah.
Why didn't they do it about... Right. We will discuss that maybe one day, but not now. The point is, we got another two films to count down.
Thomas N. Dish's underwhelming sequel, based on the book sequel, has
that's,
our heroes...
That's the description.
Yes.
Already evaluating it.
I have to talk about the songs in this film, especially the first one, when
yeah,
they bring the baby
yeah.
home.
Dad, I wanted to end my life. Yeah. I was going.
Yeah. I just wanted to walk off into the desert and never come back. While that was
they go sailing inside the Supreme Leader of Mars... who is a giant fridge, across his giant frozen oceans, and eventually get to another smaller freezer, in which is another hearing aid of Einstein.
Who is actually the Supreme Leader the whole time.
Science that doesn't make sense, which is common to kids' movies and I accept, but then at the same time, it's quoting unified field theory. And that is upsetting.
Don't give lectures on Einstein's theories when you flew to Mars in a laundry basket with a fan.
In at number two, another brilliant film by me, Dot and the Kangaroo.
You didn't make it.
By me choosing it. I feel like I own it. I do actually own it. It's great. Dot and the Kangaroo from 1977. A ginger Aussie girl gets lost in the outback and is rescued by a bunch of agitated singing animals. Even though it's an educational children's musical, it is still one of the most tragic and horrifying things I have literally ever seen.
This is nightmarish.
Yeah. And just for this podcast, I decided to look at some of the sequels, because there's eight Dot movies, and oh my god, they keep giving. They're so weird. But
we're going to end up doing all of them.
Yeah. There's one where Doc goes around the world with Santa. Makes no fucking sense.
Do they all have the kind of weird, depressing tone?
I was going to say, does Santa abandon her at the end?
Yes, sort of. Not really, kind of. I mean, it's difficult. I can't get into that one. It's really random. But the was weird, right? One of the other sequels is called Dot and the Koala. That's oddly a political film. Like, it's all about different animals having different opinions on whether they should build a dam. And it's about, like, the Australian outback animals taking on the clothed, like, animals that live in a town. And it's actually about politics. It's like Che Guevara kind of taking down the establishment. It's like properly a political film. It's baffling. And it kind of a good allegory for how people get brainwashed in modern politics into having more right-wing opinions than they actually do. It was terrifyingly bleak. And Dot isn't in it for 50 minutes, which is kind of good. But yeah, I haven't explored them all. But my god, there's a back catalogue of Dot films we haven't talked about. But this first one started it all and was a fantastic podcast, mainly because I got to argue with the three of you. About its merits.
It's definitely, I mean, it has a place. It's an interesting film. It's ugly as sin. It has that terrifying Bunyip song.
That's
that is notorious all over
the
internet.
Bunyip song. It's so depressing and scary, and it frightens me still.
It's also very Australian.
And weird.
It has a weird Spike Milligan
as a
cameo.
That's right.
Yeah. It's just a bizarre film. I can't imagine watching it as a child and it not upsetting me.
And it's oddly, yeah. It's mixed media in a sense, because it's live footage with animation over it. Like, it's kind of real life photographs, and it's cheap as well. It's got very few frames to the animation at sometimes. And like the songs loop and repeat sometimes.
Oh,
that's
God.
The other thing. The sequels, they recycle a lot from the first film. They like keeping the old music and losing the words and some of the footage and animation they use again.
God, because it was all so good.
Recut the first film in a different order and just be like, there you go, Dot the Kangaroo 2.
Dot Around the World starts with live-action humans and they transform into animations. Then there's literally 5 minutes where they play Dot and the Kangaroo again. Just to explain the story.
Oh, fill you in.
This film is like, for a film which is essentially just like, here's a new animal and here's a song about it, repeat 12 times. It has like the most depressing ending I have ever seen in a kid's movie.
Yeah, the kangaroo doesn't give a shit about you, Dot.
It just ends literally in tears. Like, it's so mournful.
Yeah.
And the whole time, there's, like, family members looking for Dot who's lost, and they're upset, and one of them gets ill.
Crying.
Dot crying pretty much cries herself to sleep every night. And then there's happy songs about birds dancing and frogs on logs, and... Oh, it's such a weird piece of the 70s. And there's just this mad Australian people who keep producing Dot films, like, one after the other. Abby, Dot...
It is just the punishing dourness. It just, as I was watching it, I was like, this, I feel like it is putting lead in my heart.
Yeah, it drains you of life while you're watching it. And I don't know which was worse to actually watch, The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars or Dot and the Kangaroo. Because, like, The Brave Little Toaster is terrible, but at least it's silly and, you know, somewhat cheerful.
It doesn't the kangaroo's depress just, you, yeah.
Yeah, it's not like everyone will abandon you, children.
And the kangaroo the has, end. Like, the story where she's looking for her presumed dead little Joey. So her child is dead, and she feels sympathy towards Dot, even though the animals don't like humans. All the animals are really antisocial towards humans anyway, and think she's an ignorant little shit. And she is, in fairness, Dot.
She is, yeah.
And, oh, it's just, I don't know, I could keep talking about it, but we've already done so, so we should put it to bed. But I can tell you, good news, watching the sequels, although I think they're going to undo the... Now, I don't think there's a... like Bond, you can't join them all up with them and make sense of it. But in some of the sequels, Dot finds Joey, and he's escaped from the cruel Russian circus with a dancing bear. And he's escaped across the world, and Dot eventually finds this little Joey belonging to the original kangaroo. But also, in Dot and the Bunny, Dot finds a, like, the kangaroo from the first film becomes the surrogate mother of the bunny because the bunny's parents are dead. So she adopts this bunny and pretends it's her own. She literally pretends it's Joey and, like, no, no, I recognise you, you're a kangaroo, get in my pouch. And so I don't know if they rewrite the story to make sense. But that's some of the stuff that happened after the first one. Yeah, it's more harrowing and more bizarre as it goes on. This isn't the worst list, by the way. This is just our favourite conversation. So don't you think that this is a counter of the bad ones?
It turns out that the ones you pick were shit.
And the most interesting to chat about. Here's a clip anyway, blah, 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 whatever. I have given you the most bleak and depressing film I know. And it is still also an Australian musical for children.
Well, almost all the animals have some voice that's in the register of like, and it's, oh, that's another character who sounds like somebody backing a tractor up a chalkboard.
These songs are eroding my soul.
I was really disappointed that the Bunyip never actually turned up, because I wanted this film to have a monster other than Dot.
Like, I think we can all say that there's nothing really in here for anyone over the age of 7.
But then I wouldn't want kids to watch this either, because it would give them a horrible, skewed vision of what you're supposed to be.
Yeah, don't show it to children. It says a lot for the film that nobody dies in it, but all of us, the message we took from it is death.
Yeah.
Finally, favourite conversation we had, and one of our favourite films in a sense, is Vampire's Kiss from 1989. The plot is Nick Cage thinks he's a vampire and goes mental for about an hour and 40 minutes.
The best thing about this is that we didn't even have a vote. I didn't put 3 forward, and then we went, I want this one, I want this one. I went, do you fancy Vampire's Kiss? Everyone, yes.
Yep.
Yeah, and also, this was like immediately just it was just kind of like unsaid that this is our favourite podcast.
I recall, before Jamie joined the podcast, we would often chat to Jamie in a subway in Carmarthen, and we would discuss films and whatnot. And I think one of the first films we all bonded over, or re-bonded over, was talking about Vampire's Kiss. And I think Jamie recommended it initially as a, if you like Nick Cage, you should see this. Mm. And we did, and we all went, wow. And we've all fell in love with it in our own way. And that's why it was so easy when Abby suggested that we should do it for the podcast. It was like, yep. So
I just sort of discovered it online through like clips and stuff, and I, you know, everyone knows the whole Nick Cage persona, but I was watching the clips thinking, what the fuck is this? Again, it's another one of the ones that kind of breaks the sort of rule that we have about trying to do films that people have forgotten about, because it's one of those films that is well discussed and notorious all over the internet, but you can't not talk about it, because it is one of those films that it's an anomaly. There is nothing else really like it. I can't figure out why it was made, who it was made for, whether it's supposed to be funny or not.
Yeah.
It's just there.
And every single line is quotable. Like, there's not a single line of dialogue that isn't fun to say back, either in Nicolas Cage's dialogue or anyone. Like, just everything is just...
It's
wow.
Nuts. And his bizarre accent.
It's sort of like if Christian Bale had done a bad job in American Psycho, isn't it?
I think I did during the podcast say that this is actually kind of similar to American Psycho. Like it's the same sort of, it's saying the same kind of thing, just in a much stranger way.
It's like he's doing a Keanu Reeves impression at some points as well. It's really odd. And he has amazing hair that kind of juts out slightly too much, even though it's slick back. And
he's terrible in it, but he's great in it as well. He's so entertaining.
There is one person we fell in love with in this film, and Abby, I'd quite like you to discuss a little bit because I feel like you'd enjoy it. Alva. That's right. She knew. Alva.
It never just goes away. Oh, God, there's so much.
She was perfectly cast as well. She's the pretty girl at the office, but she's not too pretty. But she's sort of, she's a little bit frumpy, but not too frumpy. Mm. And it's just, you have so much sympathy for her.
Yeah, you really do feel bad for her. But there's so many things Nicolas Cage did for this film for no reason. Because he ate a cockroach on camera.
Yeah.
He fired off a blank into his mouth.
Oh my God. I mean, that's how Brendan Lee died. Well, he didn't do it to himself. Nicolas Cage is that mad.
He also, in the same scene, cries by literally shouting boo-hoo. I mean, he puts in those fake vampire teeth.
Every scene goes is to gold. The nightclub.
I love his pigeon.
When he's just saying, the alphabet to his psychiatrist is the funniest thing. He pronounces each word almost differently, and just every letter's like A B C. He just gets like a child, and it's amazing. And
that's all you have to do.
Oh, so it's just the best film ever. I mean, I love Vampire's Kiss, and I love it. Doesn't fully commit to explaining itself. It sort of implies Nicolas Cage goes mad and thinks he's a vampire.
But yeah.
But does he just go actually mad? It doesn't quite explain what the purpose of the film was. It just...
Yeah, it doesn't really have a message. No. Really, it's this weird idea, and they went, yeah, let's do it.
How weird could Nick Cage be? Turns out, very fucking weird.
Weirdest.
Yeah, sort of kills himself at the end.
Yeah, I mean, just... It's a descent into madness is the closest thing I get to explaining it properly.
In the story and for the viewer.
Yeah. the underwhelming thing about mentioning Vampire's Kiss is there's nothing to say. You have to watch it.
You can talk about it forever, but it does not do justice to actually watching one of the weirdest films that's
so funny.
Has ever been made. And not weird in the... You know, when someone watches a David Lynch film, they're like, oh, it's so fucked up. No. This is weird because
Nicolas
Cage
even
figure out
has a fit, falls to the ground, shuffles under his couch. Like, he fights.
I forgot about that.
So many things, though. So
there's so many little moments, like when he's trying to get the bat out and he goes, shoo, shoo. And then, he pauses, puts a little bit of hair behind his ear, and then runs out.
And just the fact that it's funny to, it's one of the few films where a woman is tortured and, well, not, you know, she's tortured in a more of a psychological way. Some of the funniest things I've ever seen. You feel bad for her, but at the same time, it's
brilliant.
This
film is just indefinable.
I don't even know what genre it is. Is it horror? Is it a psychological thriller? Is it comedy? I don't know.
And it's just like whatever Nicolas Cage was, whatever he was like high on must. I want
I'm
some
pretty
of
sure
that.
It's just that's just him.
Pure uncut Cage.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just what was he thinking? But I'm glad he was thinking it because here it is, and it's amazing.
It is.
But it wouldn't have become the cult hit that it has become without. Cage just going full tilt at it. Like, he ran at it head first and then smashed into it because he had his eyes closed and was flailing his arms around. The reason I enjoy this film so much is because I don't understand what was going on in Cage's head when he came up with this performance. And
you don't know if he's a genius or the lunatic that he's portraying.
That's one of the things about this movie. It's you're watching it and each moment comes by and you think, it can't get any better than this. But it just keeps coming.
There's so much to say about this film, and yet it leaves you speechless immediately afterwards.
It's kind of so bad it's good, but so good at being bad it's better than all of the so bad it's good films.
Too late.
It's all too late, Alva. Yeah, so I mean, there's not. I feel like watching Vampire's Kiss now, so we should wrap up the podcast with a few honourable mentions and last statistics. I think Anthony has got some little stats for us. Anthony, can we have some stats to finish us off?
Yeah. How many times have I mentioned The Exorcist in all time?
We've 1,300,000. I don't know. I've got a few little stats. So, like, we have the most recurring actors who always seem to pop up in our films. And we have a clear winner with 5 times appearances by Robin Williams, who was in Toys, Popeye, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, Death to Smoochie, and most recently Fern Gully.
Oh.
And then we got a tie for second place. With 4, we have Tim Curry and Gina Davis. Mm. And then we got a lot of people with 3 films, such as Michael Caine, Fisher Stevens, Danny DeVito, Jeffrey Jones, Michael Lerner, Phil Hartman, Max von Sydow, and Bruce McGill. So well done, all of you people, for being in our films.
I wouldn't go out of my way to congratulate Jeffrey Jones on anything nowadays. No. You know, let's hold back the kudos for him. Over that
one. He just, you know, he's in some films that we found worth reviewing. But Robin Williams seems to be the thing. When we're subconsciously picking these things, he's in our minds. He's a spoiler-filled champion that we always come to because he falls beautifully between great and terrible. And that's the zone we like to plummet through, to dig through. We like the mediocre, the weird, the unsung. And Robin Williams, always there, always in something or other. It's an interesting one.
Ooh. A lot of the films that we've done with him in actually sum up quite well the kinds of films that we go for. Like, you've got Death to Smoochie, where he's entertaining, but the film isn't. Or The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, where it's way too over the top, and it's just kind of gross and annoying.
Yeah, and then for the second place, we have kind of Tim Curry and Gina Davis, who are kind of the opposite. They're kind of, they're quality actors, but they tend to pick some questionable films.
But have also been in great films.
Oh, of course. So has Robin Williams, to be fair.
Oh yeah, no. Where is Gina Davis now? Is like, did she become a nun or something? She's disappeared.
No, she went into production a bit, but she's also an activist for representation on television, so that women and minority groups get first of all represented at all, and then represented in ways that are good,
positive.
Mm. Oh, that, you say that. So you say that, though, she does star in our youngest film that we reviewed, which is In a World.
And she plays she's a producer who wants the voiceover woman because she's a woman. So it kind of ties into feminine activism type stuff.
There you go. That's the kind of thing, you know, we can congratulate her and, you know, not talk about Jeffrey Jones.
Well, you've brought up again. So. it's just a sense of the tone. These, like Tim Curry, I think we all subconsciously love and always want to talk about. So he turns up in these things. Anthony,
I was going to say, but then you pick one of his films and watch it and go, "Oh, that's a shame."
Wish he was in. Yeah. Anthony, who is our most common director we've talked about?
Okay, well, we haven't chosen very many directors repeatedly. We got a tie for second place between 3 people. They are William Friedkin, who's directed Cruising and Sorcerer. John Carpenter, who directed Memoirs of an Invisible Man and In the Mouth of Madness. And also Sam Peckinpah, who directed Convoy and Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia. So, like, those are some respectable directors there in second place. However, our first place... with three films that have ended up on the spoiler-filled chopping board is Peter Hyams, who has directed Outland, Time Cop, and Stay Tuned. And these are some of his better films, luckily, that we've ended up kind of seeing.
Outland's really good. Yeah. Stay Tuned. No.
He did the sequel to 2001, which is surprisingly decent. Also stars Roy Scheider. Scheider's craggy face in space.
Yeah. I don't know what it says about us having that director recur the most, but I guess he hits the sort of spoiler-filled vibe the most times. We'll see how things go. Maybe we'll repeat directors in future or find some new ones. We'll see.
I think Peter Hyams does his career kind of sums up the decent but often a bit shoddy that we tend to like go for a lot of the time.
It's on a par with us. That's good.
Yeah,
I was quite surprised that we've only done one film by Stuart Gordon, which was Robot Jocks, because some of his films are prime spoiler-filled material, and I'm sure we'll be suggesting a few in the future.
Well, I assumed that he'd never worked again.
He's got quite a prolific back catalogue.
Well, if we ever end up doing 100, I can tell you who will be the director we do the most, and his name is Yoram Gross, and he directs all the Dot films. There's eight of them, so enjoy. Any more statistics, Anthony? Any more?
Oh, we've got a few. I've got a breakdown of kind of like all the eras of films we've got. So our most popular era, or decade, if you will, is the 90s. Where we've chosen 50 films.
One of the other reasons we pick films is we go back to our childhood video stores mentally and pick off the shelf the things we either remember or wanted to see when we were young, and then we look at them again or for the first time. So that makes sense that the 90s is so popular with us.
And then the 80s is the second popular with 36. Then the 2000s with 25, the 1970s with 17, 1960s, we have 9 films from the 60s, 6 films from the 50s, which I was quite surprised, more films than from the 2010s, although to be fair, we've only had half of that decade. We've had 1 film from the 30s, but unfortunately no films from the 40s. So
there was a war on, in fairness. Don't go watch some arty propaganda films. That's what we need to do.
Yeah, we'll get on that. It's all right.
Yeah. Abby, you're going to take a mental note. We need some 40s.
I'm going to take an actual physical note.
Oh, good. Me and Anthony also argued slightly over what genres are what and what ones are which genre. And we tried to categorise, but there was some difficult debate as to which ones fall into which ones. But do you have any thoughts on it, Anthony, now that you've looked at the chart?
Yeah, I was going to say, because it's us and the types of films we choose, like, a lot of the time there's a very mixed tone and some of the films are kind of uncategorizable.
Yeah.
So we've done our best. And we've got a kind of general catch-all genre of thriller, which kind of encompasses action, crime, thriller and mysteries, and we have 40 films in that kind of category. Then comedy, quotation marks comedy, then comes in with 29, sci-fi/fantasy with 27, drama 23, family, which is mainly just our terrible childhood children's films with 15, horror with 9, musical with 2, we've done 2 westerns, 1 war film and 1 documentary.
And the war film was a war sports film in the shape of Escape to Victory. So that kind of is our one sports movie. Oh no, we've done movies with footballers in. That's okay.
Yes, a surprising amount considering none of us like sport in the slightest.
We have 2 films featuring invisible Frenchmen. Bogus.
Invisible imaginary Frenchmen.
That's right. Bogus and Looking for Eric. But there's lots of pairs. We have lots of themes that reoccur, lots of titles that repeat, like Memoirs of a Geisha, Memoirs of the Invisible Man, for example. Like, we do lots of pairings that go together. But, I think the last thing we're going to do is just shout names of films you think people should listen to, and then we're done, because it's been a marathon.
You mean ones we've done, or ones in general?
Well, we have an honourable mentions of things we might have talked about, but we didn't quite find enough reason to mention them. So does this someone want to read the list out, or just shout whatever they feel like?
I think just kind of claim your own films that you brought forward.
Okay.
So
Super Mario Brothers.
Yes, insane. Some of mine, like The Rookie, which is a weird, don't know if it's supposed to be a serious or parody of Clint Eastwood films made by and starring Clint Eastwood.
It is amazing.
And also The Seven Faces of Dr. Low.
Oh, that was a wonder, yeah.
Such a weird little old film, that one.
Really strange, really enjoyable, but yeah, I mean, there's so much. There was a lot to talk about with Dr. Lou and his seven faces. I'm going to say Ghost Dad, winner
of
one of
Jeffrey Jones. Holy shit!
Was he in that?
No, but Bill Cosby has had some.
We didn't discuss Bill Cosby's controversy because it was pre the big news, so we don't mention it. But Ghost Dad as a title is just one of the lamest and best. Ghost Dad. It's about Bill Cosby being a ghost dad. The film makes no sense. I loved it. Also, Dougal and the Blue Cat. That was a good discussion.
Oh, God. Yeah.
As was, you know, I think we did mention it a bit, but Popeye was quite a good chat. And the only other thing that I'm going to mention, then I'll let one of you guys go. Going South, I managed to get through the whole podcast without letting you, Anthony and Jamie, know I hadn't seen the film. Didn't have a clue. So that's the only one I didn't watch. No, there was another film I watched, Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I did the podcast without seeing the film, but I said up front that so those are the only two I did without seeing the film. Otherwise, I've been in on all 150. So
we applaud you, Rich, for being the only one to have done every single one of these episodes. So well done.
Yes,
I'm going to crowbar in one more Exorcist promo and mention the Ninth Configuration, which I did, which I brought to the table. And I think it was one of the ones that got a really positive response that I kind of wasn't expecting, because it's a very odd film that's kind of part of the Exorcist canon, and is just really good if you like strange one-offs.
It was an interesting one. We all sort of went, God, what a strange little film. Any more? Abby, do you have any you want to champion?
I want to... First I'll mention My Dog Tulip.
Yeah, me and you did that really one together.
Yeah, and it's a charming little film and people should watch it. I also want to mention that there's one of the very earliest podcasts is on Batman Forever. It was one that Steve did. And I feel like that's one of my spiritual ones, because I still would have if you hadn't already done it.
Yeah, you and Jamie have mentioned the first one we ever did, but you weren't there. It was me, Anthony, and Steve. And you guys subsequently, I'm sure Abby and Jamie have thoughts they have that could have been in it, but just wasn't.
Well,
didn't happen.
Yeah, Batman Forever, one of those films I remember loving, and then you go back and watch it as an adult and you're like, ah, this is shit.
We were surprisingly positive towards it in the podcast, weirdly.
Yeah. I wouldn't be.
Also, that's the thing. I feel like it's the show that never was. It's me and Jamie arguing about Batman Forever, because we can't, because it's done.
We should revisit some of the ones before we got a defined idea of what we were doing with this podcast.
Because this podcast isn't indulgent enough as it is. Abby, I'm
surprised... Yeah, let's do some remakes of old episodes.
We are, kind of, in this episode. Abby, I'm surprised you haven't mentioned Iga, which is one of the other good titles, because it's, like, just a noise. With Richard Keel.
Yes, but... He is a good thing in something that is questionable.
Yeah. Any more? Last chance.
Nothing came up in vote.
What about...
Especially...
What about Priscilla? Do you want to...
Oh, shit.
That's famous.
But we should say it's really good. And we all really enjoyed it and enjoyed talking about it. It's a very good film.
Yeah, Priscilla...
And it made Jamie tolerate ABBA. Which is an achievement in itself.
Oh, that is it.
It has the best abbreviation, like acronym. Not acronym, is it? When you put all the letters, it's just TAOPQOTD. That's so uncatchy to say. The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. So I like it because it shortens to that. Okay. So if no one's got any more honourable mentions, which is best, we may as well just count off the 150 at this point.
Yeah. Let's name every single episode we've ever done.
The Killing of Sister George. Two lesbians have a fight in the 60s, and it's really strange. And, you know, like, there are some great films. But we've definitely run out of steam, so...
Go back and listen to our old episodes. Judge us, tell us how shit we are in the comments.
Yeah, Christ, like, feedback. It's not a one-way street, yeah. Guys. We blather, then you blather via text and email and comment.
Tell us why we're wrong in all our film opinions.
Because sometimes, like, statistically, we've got to be, surely.
Help me defend Super Mario Brothers.
Whatever you
want to
say.
Help him defend Super Mario Brothers.
help me defend rock and roll.
Suggest any films you like. Any feedback, any comments, all welcome in any direction. Twitter, we're on there. Facebook, we're definitely on there. Tumblr, we're on there. WordPress is where you probably found the website. On iTunes is also fine. All those outlets, anything you want, chuck it at us. We're more than happy to hear you. And
give us a nice one-star review.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So.
150 episodes.
Fuck. Here's to another 1,000. We haven't done all the films yet.
Bye.
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 Bye-bye.